This episode is brought to you by Winsun, a Taiwanese-American restaurant located in East Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Learn more at winsunbrooklyn.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good evening and welcome to
Foment About It
on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm Mary Izette, your co-host through this journey of all things fermented. And as you can tell, I am not joined by Chris Kuzme nor Rachel Jacobs tonight, but I have a special co-host, Dave Krako from Arcane Distilling.
Hello.
And so it is our 200th episode, which is kind of amazing. I don't know where all those episodes have been. Anyway, it has been an absolutely amazing journey. I'm very sad that Chris and Rachel are not here. Chris is in Washington, D.C. for the annual Craft Brewers Conference. And then it is Passover this week. So Rachel is having hopefully a very happy Passover. All right. I do have a couple of announcements. So first off is Books and Brews. So this is a members only and host get together for Heritage Radio Network. So it will be at the Three's Outpost in Greenpoint. They're going to feature a book, and this week it's an author. This week it's the lovely Kathy Irway. Oh my God, I cannot. All right, I got to get with it. at 6 p.m. again at the Three's Outpost in Greenpoint. And if you do not support, if you are not yet a member of Heritage Radio Network, now is the perfect time to do it. As many of you know, we're a not-for-profit internet radio station in the middle of Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and we need your support to continue with all of these great shows. I'm so privileged to be part of the Heritage Radio Network family, and it's just been an amazing 200 episodes. I have learned so much. I have lots of new favorite foods. I can make a whole heck of a lot more fermented foods, and best of all, I think, is that we have met a ton of great people through either show-related fermentation events or through the show itself. So I'm very thankful to be part of HRN, and I hope you guys are thankful to be listening out there. All right, next announcement. The Pride of Brooklyn Homebrew Fest is coming out, but it is sold out. National Homebrewers Conference will be in Minneapolis, June 15th through 17th. It is still open for registration. You can go to homebrewcon.org or homebrewcon.com. They both will direct you there. There's a very special event coming up in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hang on, let me bring up my email here. It is called On the Rise, the Future of Bread. It is at the Johnson & Wales University. It's the first international symposium on bread. It'll be Monday and Tuesday, May 22nd through 23rd of this year at the JWU Charlotte campus. It's basically aiming to unite influential scholars, authors, agriculturists, historians, media, millers, and bakers from across the U.S. and Europe. You can find it on Eventbrite, and they do have a special hotel rate at the nearby DoubleTree Hotel. So I have to say, bread is something that's near and dear to my heart. This is actually organized by Peter Reinhardt, is the executive director. He is an absolutely amazing person. He's written some very influential books on bread making, and look over the email. There are some incredible speakers that will be at this, including Chad Robertson, who many of you know from Tartine. Glenn Roberts is the founder of Anson Mills. There was a couple other, Francisco Migoya, I might be butchering that name, but he leads the baking team at the Modernist Cuisine Food Lab. So this looks like an amazing event. I kind of want to go. I don't know if I could swing it, but I'm actually going to look into it when I get home tonight because it sounds incredible. All right. So tonight, our 200th episode, we are finally, I feel like there's a lot of subjects that we have been meaning to do more or to talk about or to devote whole shows on, and that we haven't really gotten a chance to until recently. If you guys have tuned in recently, 2 weeks ago, I learned to actually pronounce the word shochu. And I feel like I could go in and order a shochu with some knowledge of what I'm getting and what I'm drinking and be able to taste it. And then last week we had an episode about coffee. And if you guys listen to that, you'll be happy to know that now Chris and I are heating our water to 195. I do pay attention and I'm enjoying my coffee even more so than I was before. We haven't done some of the coffee tests like comparing our grinds yet. If you didn't listen last week, Chris and I drink our coffee very differently, and we have very different prep. We usually drink different coffees, different coffee beans. Anyway, so sadly, that just makes me more sad that Chris isn't here because he, of all people, is a great, great lover of chocolate. And we are joined in the studio tonight by Nate Hodge, who is the co-founder and head chocolate maker at Rocka Chocolate. Is that even, how do you pronounce Rocka?
You said it perfectly. Actually, it's really funny. So it's a Finnish word. And so we've always pronounced it as Rocka. And recently we met some Finnish people at a trade show who pronounced it Rocka.
Rocka.
So I
sounds
think we're
like
gonna,
a bird
I think,
call.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, my name like has it. A silent J in it, and I don't even go there.
So I think we're going to keep pronouncing it Rocka, but that was something interesting we learned that all this time.
And now you won't be surprised if people pronounce it Rocka.
I don't think anyone in the U.S. is going to just happen upon that pronunciation.
No, probably.
We get a lot of Reka.
I bet. All right, so let's talk about how did you get into chocolate?
How did I get into chocolate? Some things, you know, just sort of happen, I guess. But I, in college, I was really interested. Me and my friends were really interested in where things come from. And so we did a lot of experiments with food, a lot of experiments with fermented food, lots of pickle making, beer making, wine making, making barbecue sauce from different styles of vinegar, that sort of thing. And then when I graduated college, after a few years, I came to New York and was working in the food industry, trying to cut my teeth. And the story behind the beginning of Rocka is really a funny sort of early 2000s story where I responded to a Craigslist ad from someone who was making chocolate in their apartment. And it happened to be the co-founder of Rocka, Ryan Cheney. And before meeting him, I had done a little bit of experiments with chocolate myself. I actually bought cocoa beans at a farmer's market in Boston in 2003 and proceeded to try to roast them in my oven at around 400 degrees, and they exploded, and I started a fire in the oven of my apartment. So it's kind of serendipitous that the company Ryan also wanted to make chocolate without roasting it because I failed my first time for sure.
So Ryan on the Craigslist was just looking for somebody that was interested in making chocolate.
Yeah, he was like, I want to start a company and I need help, basically. And we hit it off. He was really interested in sort of the social impact side, and that was sort of what we bonded over. I'm way more into food than he is. He's way more into design and the design elements that go into starting a consumer packaged goods company,
which you can tell because your packaging
is
beautiful.
I think that's one of the advantages that we've had is both of us have done a really good job, hopefully, in our prospective corners. So we really bonded. I think we both graduated. I'm 30. I don't remember how old he is. He's a few years older than me. But we sort of, I think we're the end of whatever the generation is before millennials, where when we were in college, sort of the...
Gen X? Is that right? I don't know.
Technically, you're still a millennial. Sorry.
Yeah, technically still a millennial. The very beginning of the millennials. But we like graduated. We both like went to liberal arts school at this time when it was like, okay, you... the noble thing is to become an artist or a doctor or a lawyer, and anything to do with business is sort of frowned upon, or you know, you're automatically a conservative asshole if you want to do anything with business. And I think we both approach Rocca in a way, and we see it as a way in which we can sort of reinvent the way business is done through producing really high quality products, and that's sort of how we bonded over the project.
Awesome. So similar philosophy.
Yeah, exactly.
Very cool. All right. So talk about how, so where do you guys, so you met, you bonded, what happened next?
Oh my.
Cause what year was that? That was
2009, 2010, maybe 2010. So we made chocolate, in my apartment for a while and in a commercial kitchen in Long Island City that we, only had enough money to rent the overnight shift.
Yes. This is not atypical here in New York City, by the way.
Yeah, it seems like I know a lot of people now with similar stories, and everyone has stories of either renting like the basement of a restaurant that like they were not using because it was infested with God knows what, or working the overnight shift at a commercial kitchen. It's pretty much how it starts. So we were doing farmers markets Saturdays and Sundays, and then Sunday night, we would take all kinds of equipment to a commercial kitchen in Long Island City and work from 5 p.m. until 2 a.m. was our shift. But we would pay the security guy at the commercial kitchen an extra like $100 or whatever to let us stay until 4. So we would work a farmer's market from, you know, 9 a.m. until 4 p.m.
5 to 5, man. Yeah, sounds good to me.
The good old 5 to 5. Yeah.
That's intense. And now...
So after doing that for about 6 months, we got a space in right across the street from the Navy Yards in Clinton Hill, right off Flushing Avenue. And this actually was a bunch of food companies in that building for a while. The Granola Labs people were there. I think Salty Road Taffy just moved, but they were in there for a long time. Yeah, so we were in there with a bunch of companies in the second floor industrial loft that the freight elevator was broken on. So we had to, for a while, carry our sacks of cocoa beans. They would arrive on a pallet. We would have to pull them off the pallet and take them up the stairs. So that was fun. And now in 2014... the fall of 2014, we moved into our factory in Red Hook, right off of Van Brunt Street.
Not too far from Driftaway Coffee, right?
Not too far from Driftaway Coffee.
I mean, same neighborhood. So Red Hook,
not
Brooklyn.
Not too far from Van Brunt Stillhouse. Not too far from Stumptown. So, yeah.
Steve's Key Lime still there, too?
Yeah. We're on the north side of the neighborhood, really close to the Battery Tunnel. Right around the corner from Brooklyn Slate.
Okay. So that's... kind of southwest Brooklyn, for those of you who don't live here. It's right on the water. It's not very subway accessible necessarily.
It's the ferry.
Yeah, it's where IKEA and Fairway is. But it's a really cool neighborhood, and there's a lot of cool, obviously, small manufacturers.
It's fun, yeah. We enjoy it. And we've been surprised at the reception we've gotten and the amount of people that were able to sort of schlep their way out there on the weekend, whether they're taking an Uber from the city or coming on the ferry or walking from the subway or driving in through Staten Island or New Jersey. But yeah, it's been sort of fun to see the response.
That's a good, like, I'm big on these weekend walkabout. So like just pick a neighborhood on a Saturday and then just walk it. And that's Red Hook is a great neighborhood.
It is.
For
and
that.
it's really funny because we've determined that on all the Monday holidays, we have to have extra staff because we get those people on Memorial Day, Labor Day, Columbus Day that all decide on that Monday that let's just stay in the city and walk a neighborhood. And Red Hook, I think, is a popular destination for that.
Yeah. Beautiful. Like you could see the Statue of Liberty. It's probably the best.
Before we even had the factory there, whenever I had out of town company, I would take them to Red Hook to see the Statue of Liberty. Yeah. There it is.
It's that or the Staten Island Ferry. Those are my two favorite places. Okay, so let's talk about chocolate. So chocolate is cacao is a bean.
Yeah, it's technically a seed.
A seed.
So cacao grows as a fruit. And the cacao bean is the unfermented seed of the cocoa fruit.
So how do you get from from bean to bar?
Great.
Or let's start with how you guys get from bean to bar, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about.
Sure.
You know.
So a cocoa tree takes about 3 to 5 years to fruit. And those fruits range in size from about the size of your fist to like the size of a football. And inside those pods, there's a white fruit that's sort of like a mucilage, like a sticky substance. And inside that white sticky substance is the seeds. Each pod has anywhere between 15 and 40 seeds. So what typically happens is those pods are harvested. They're cut open and all the mucilage and the seeds are scooped out together and put into a bag or a bucket. And then those bags and buckets that are full of this sort of half liquid, half goop, seedy, pulpy mess are taken to fermentation boxes, which hold anywhere between 30 and 150 kilos of that sort of mix. They call it baba, which is the mix of the fruit and the seeds. And that fruit is really high in sugars. And those seeds are really high in amino acids. And the goal of fermentation in cacao is to take those really complex amino acids and break them down so that you can taste the nuances of them. So it's not just hitting your mouth as extreme bitterness or really intense tannins. So they're left to sit in a big box.
Are these boxes like stacked on top of each
other? Yeah, it depends on where you are. I mean, it ranges. There's not really there are some depending on where you go, there's different standards of fermentation. I think there's a lot of education still happening in various areas. And so you're starting to find that people are developing a singular language and a singular method for proper cacao fermentation. But still in its like early phases, everything from putting everything, wrapping everything up in a tarp in like a giant pile to a single box that someone just sort of stirs every few hours to the more complex fermentation, which is more of what we're looking for, which in a lot of times is a tiered box system. And so what you want is a mixture of aerobic and anaerobic reaction in that fermentation. So you want to make sure you move those boxes over every few days so that you're getting airflow so you can have that aerobic reaction. So fermentation takes anywhere from 5 to 8 days, depending on where you are. Closer to the equator, it generally tends to take less time.
Because probably heat acts temperature dependent.
Temperature dependent for sure. And a lot depends on the fat content in the actual cocoa beans. So when you get closer to the equator, you're going to have less fat in your cocoa beans. And so as a result of that, the fermentation generally tends to speed up a little bit. So in Ecuador, for instance, it's pretty much a standard fermentation, for a large portion of the country. It's like a 1-2-2-1 in terms of a 4-tier box system, 1 day in the first box, 2 days in the second box, 2 days in the third box, 1 day in the fourth box. Huh.
What kind of microbes are we talking?
Oh, that's like beyond my level of expertise.
But come on, man, it's fermentable.
I know.
But probably a variety of microbes.
A variety. And it's going to vary, too. I mean, a lot. People use different types of wood depending on where you are.
But they're not introducing like yeast or bacteria.
This is all happening naturally. Yeah, it's all happening naturally. It's all happening naturally.
Because I know I read recently or some articles a couple months ago where I don't know if they're doing it in real life yet or just in a lab where people are actually experimenting with introducing, I believe, yeast and maybe bacteria to kind of, have more control over like what flavors and aromas and compounds are being made.
Repeatability.
For sure. Yeah. There's a lot of experimentation going around that. The problem is implementing it and getting people to pay the price for controlled systems.
Right.
For having facilities that you can replicate the same. Like if you're just, if you're have a couple of boxes in the open air in a field in Peru or Tanzania or wherever, replicating that process without it being in a facility that's closed off and sanitary, you're going to get introduced to microbes 100% of the time when that's the fermentation you're dealing with.
So then, all right, so after this ferments for however long, depending where you are and everything.
Then the beans will still, at that point, the liquid from the fruit will have, for the most part, drained off, but there'll still be some sticky substance left on the beans. So you'll want to pull those beans out, and they dry in the sun or in some kind of tunnel that uses like a plastic that you would have for a greenhouse for 7 to 10 days.
And they're looking for a particular moisture content at that point.
We're looking for stability for like 7.75. Percent moisture.
So much similarity between chocolate and coffee.
Yeah. A lot of similarities for sure.
Good old water activity and preservation.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Similarly to coffee, we don't roast, but that's another thing that when you roast cocoa that they're looking for having that, sort of 7.5 to play with the, in your roast profiles.
I'm kind of interested. So the liquid just goes away.
So it drains. The bottoms of the, that's something I didn't mention. The bottoms of the boxes generally have holes in them.
Ah.
So it drains off. So
is it collected? I mean, I imagine if you're fermenting.
So yeah, I've had all kinds, Ecuador and the Dominican Republic both, make like distilled cacao drink from that fruit. And then you'll find like, anyone who does, I mean, lots of people just ferment in their backyard. And so you'll find all kinds of people that have their homemade like cacao wine, which
That's
is
cool.
pretty wild. It's intense.
So they're making it just plain fermenting and then also fermenting and distilling it. All right. So we're going to take a very brief break and then we'll come back and find out how you guys get from the beans or the seeds.
The seeds after they're dried to chocolate bars. Yeah, for sure.
Stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by Winsun, a Taiwanese American restaurant located in East Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Founded by Josh Koo and Chef Trig Brown, Winsun pays tribute to the myriad of flavors and influences of Taiwanese cuisine. They're serving Taiwanese food in their own local context, putting classic dishes like Lu Ru Fan next to new ones that showcase authentic ingredients, like noodles with shaved mullet roe, uitza, and fried chilies. The Village Voice calls the fried eggplant Winsun's sleeper hit, a Donnybrook of flavors tied together by rich, tangy yogurt. Other highlights of the menu are the Big Chicken Bun, their take on a fried chicken sandwich, or the Nutritious Sandwich, with sugar-cured Virginia ham, pickled pineapples, and jalapenos. Is your mouth watering yet? You can feel good about what you're eating. All the meats on Winsun's menu are sourced from Heritage Foods USA. Winsun's beer list offers Taiwan beer, of course, but also a selection of local brews. Wine is available by the glass and bottle. On the cocktail side, don't miss the Chinha Colada, which mixes coconut cream, rum, cilantro, and basil. For dessert, they keep it simple with the ice cream sandwich, a take on the classic Taiwanese pairing of donuts and sweetened condensed milk. You'll want to order at least one for the table. To see the full menu and to learn more, visit winsunbrooklyn.com.
Welcome back to Ferment About It. All right, so we are in the studio with Nate Hodge.
Hello.
Reaching for my sheet. Okay, so when we left off, we were talking about, so now they've dried the seeds, which are now called cacao beans, I guess.
Cacao beans, yes.
And then they, at that time, are they packaged to ship to you?
Yeah, so Depending on the country, they either do it by sacks by the pound or by the kilo. The sort of the most common you'll find is a 70 kilo sack. So we get a lot of 70 kilo sacks.
That's heavy.
Of cocoa beans. Yeah, it's heavy to drag up the stairs. Much easier to move around on pallets with a pallet jack. And one of the things that we're looking for, that's so we make the chocolate without roasting. So generally the first step is to sort of sort the beans, look for rocks, look for string, look for anything that isn't a cocoa bean, and then roast it. And that's where the development of flavor begins. For us, the fermentation is really important, since we're not roasting. So we need really consistent fermentation. Generally for like your standard large batch, commercial chocolate, the roasting step is used not only to develop flavor, but to also homogenize flavor.
Yep.
Because what you're doing is buying the lowest market price. You have your suppliers that are getting it out for you as cheaply as they can. And for us, it's really important that our fermentation is really good, and not only really good, but also to specific specs. Sort of a lot of the bigger sort of premium or specialty chocolate makers, the kind of stuff that you find that most pastry chefs like to work with, Valrhona, Guittard, some of these types of chocolate, they sort of have controlled the specialty or fine flavor cacao market. They want everything fermented to a specific spec, and that generally tends to be a little bit lower than what we're looking for, since we don't roast. Mm-hmm. And the reason they want that low is so that their secret process can sort of dictate how they develop flavor from beans that, if you were to taste them, would be like, whoa, these are really intense. These aren't like distinguishable flavors. These are really strong tannins. So we need our stuff fermented. They generally tend to want stuff in the 65 to 75% range of fermentation. What that means is when beans are fermented and dried, the way to look at the quality of them is to do what's called a cut test, where you take a random sampling of 100 beans, you cut them in half, and you look for the coloring. The seeds are purple, so they're not actually brown or black or what we generally tend to think of as the color of cocoa. They're a bright purple color. And so 65 to 75% fermentation means that after the fermentation process, you still have 35 to 25% of the beans that are still purple colored.
Oh, okay.
So we want...
So like the 75 to 85 is like the percent that's not purple, basically.
The percent that's not purple.
Okay.
So we're looking for more like 90 to 95%. Oh. And that's really difficult to do, because you run the risk at that point of over fermenting the beans. And when you over ferment the beans, you get flavors that you can't really augment.
So you can't disguise them by roasting, for instance. Is that?
Yeah, there's not a lot of, I'll describe the flavors to you, and then you can see like why the roast wouldn't do too much to those flavors. So the first instance of that is over fermentation, where the fermentation gets too hot, and that generally tends to produce flavors that are smoky or like ham like, or on the like really nasty side of that, stuff that starts to taste like decaying leaves essentially, or compost. And the other thing you have happen when you get fermentation that's too heavy is beans that have been fermenting for too long and haven't gotten the proper temperatures, and thus have been exposed to more oxygen than you would like, and are going to have the flavor of like when you have a bottle of wine on a Tuesday night and just have a glass and then try to and don't put the cork back in it, and then on Wednesday night you want to have another glass. It's sort of like over oxidized, super oxidized.
I mean, it's interesting. These are classic sort of examples in beer.
Yeah,
that's what
I
well.
Was. I know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, it all leads back.
I'm comparing
to
it to like
smoky ham.
Yeah. Yeah. Like a beginner, like a beginner homebrewer who makes stout. You know, it's pretty easy to make a stout at the beginning because there's a lot of roasted malts, dark malts that can disguise all flavors.
Yep.
But if you're making like a really clean lager or pilsner,
for sure,
little trickier. So that's what this is reminding me of.
Yeah,
anyway.
Exactly. So we're generally looking for more of a 90 to 95% fermentation, which makes that like margin for error a lot slimmer. So we get the beans and then our first step is to crack them and remove the fines. The fines are the pieces of the shell and the interior of the shell, which is a cocoa nib, which is the interior of the bean, if you will. So there's a shell out on the outside of the nib that together is the bean. We want the nib to make chocolate. So we have to remove the fines with suction. The fines are the pieces of shell and nib. They're too small to determine whether or not when you crack it, it's a shell or a nib. One of the other advantages to roasting is because of that moisture that's still inside the bean, it helps puff the shell away from the nib. So when you crack, you get a really clean crack. We don't get a really clean crack. We still have pieces of shell that are somewhat fused to the nibs because of that moisture. So the process of removing the shells from the nibs is one that was sort of difficult for us in the beginning. But now we have a machine that does it for us. It's called an optical sorter.
Nice.
So it's a machine that was invented in China for rice production, our specific model.
I was just about to say, is this kind of going to be kind of like polishing rice?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, there we go.
Exactly. So the optical sort, they actually use it in the final step to, like, when they're bagging the rice, remove anything that isn't rice, so sticks, leaves. We use it. The way you use it is you program it with photographs of your material. So in this case, we program with photos of nibs, photos of shell, and then photos of nibs fused to shell. And we highlight all the nibs and tell the machine, this is the good material. And then we highlight all the shell and the fused shell and nib and tell it, this is the bad material. And when the combination of all these, of the mixture of the materials is running through the main shaft of the machine, it scans it and identifies all the stuff that's not supposed to be in there. And then with a series of 60 air jets, times it to push
that's
everything.
That's awesome.
Out, which is really cool. And then it's when the guy came to install it, he was telling us about like other uses for it, which I found very fascinating. Like companies that make like cereal and potato chips use the same technology to remove like burned pieces. It's not that the fact, like when you get a bag of cereal, it's not that the factories don't burn the cereal. That'd be crazy if they were 100% not burning the cereal. So they use machines similar to this to pull out all the burnt pieces. So we use it to pull out the shell and the pieces of nib that are stuck to shell, so we can keep re-cracking that, so we can get as much yield as we possibly can get. So then we just take the raw nibs and we run them through a steel plate mill. So the nibs are roughly, it varies depending on the type of cocoa bean, but roughly 50% cocoa butter and 50% cocoa powder. And so the process of making chocolate is to, through friction, coax out the fats and refine the solids so that you get liquid molten chocolate, essentially. So we run that to start the process of breaking that down. We run that through a steel plate mill that was designed in Nebraska for small-scale corn production.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds like...
One of the challenges in sort of scaling up a chocolate business is that you have stuff that's designed for home use and for sort of your Main Street chocolatier, but you don't have stuff that's there for medium-sized companies. So it's a lot of like finding equipment from other industries or finding like old lab equipment from like Hershey's and Nestle. So like we've purchased a few machines recently that are to do a 400 kilo batch size that were at one point lab equipment for a massive chocolate company,
right,
where they're running like 4, 5, 10 tons at a time. And we're trying to run, you know, around a half a ton at a time.
You're basically talking about my specialty. That's what I do. I make the machines that don't exist because they're in that uncanny valley.
Exactly. So there's a lot of people who have sort of, who are starting to do that in chocolate. And there's some problems with the way people are approaching it, but that's a conversation for another time. So we use this steel plate mill, which is essentially like a a peanut grind, a giant peanut grinder, like you like at the grocery store when you go to make fresh peanut butter or something, only on like a 15 horsepower motor. And so the reason we want it all that much power is A, for speed, obviously, and B, to keep the so that the machine's working efficient enough so that the temperature stays low so that we can control the development of flavor later in the process instead of having incidental changes to flavor happening because that initial refinement is refining too hot. So when it comes out of there, it comes out of there at like a 85 to 90 degree paste. And will
Fahrenheit or Celsius?
Fahrenheit. Ah. Yeah. It's really funny because when it comes to cacao fermentation, since most of it happens in Latin America, I think cacao fermentation in Celsius, but everything else in Fahrenheit.
I spec all my glass in millimeters and all my metal in inches.
That's yeah, how it works. Exactly, exactly. So 90 degree paste, 90 degree Fahrenheit paste. And then we put those into stone melangeurs, which is basically a big steel bowl with a granite base and two granite rollers. And so that will further break down the size of the particles that are coming out of that massive peanut grinder. And we'll do that. We'll refine the paste for about 24 hours and then add sugar for a few hours. And then at that point, a lot of in that 24 hours, a lot of flavor development happens because we're mixing that chocolate. It's oxidizing. A lot of volatiles are leaving the chocolate. A lot of acidity is leaving that chocolate. And so there we generally tend to try to control the temperature because that's for us where a lot of our flavor development is going to happen. So after the 24 hours plus 4 to 6 for sugar refinement, we run that mixture. It's starting to look like chocolate, starting to look like smooth liquid chocolate. But when you taste it, it's still going to have some, still going to be a little granular. We run that through a three-roll mill, which is a machine with that's three giant steel rollers that are spaced really, really close together. And you pour the chocolate on there. And it pulls the chocolate through the rolls and refines it. So that speeds up that process of refinement for us, but it also evens the size of the particles. So we can refine in those stone grinders to a pretty small, and we can refine below 20 microns, which is where your palate's supposed to not be able to sense the difference, sense particle size anymore. But what happens is that it's not the most... all the particles don't go under those rollers an equal number of times. So you'll have a range. So even if all the particles are below 20 microns, if you have some particles that are at 4 microns and some particles that are at 19, 20 microns, your palate's still going to sense that difference. So we pull it through this these giant steel rolls to flatten everything out so that it's the same size.
This is more complex than I.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, it reminds me of paint production.
So the three-roll mill that we have, so generally in chocolate, in large-scale chocolate, like massive-scale chocolate production, you have a five-roll mill. And we have a little three-roll mill that actually was used for ink refinement at some point. And we got the rolls like re-seasoned for us to use for chocolate making. But yeah, it's used a lot in inks and paints. They've actually that's what the three roll mill is like designed for initially. They've also like repurposed them for the cosmetic industry for like refining seaweed and stuff. It's funny, all the machines that are like, even our machines that do that initial breakdown were originally spice grinders that were used in India for grinding like chai spices and curry spices and stuff. And we use it for chocolate now. So it goes through those rolls, and it comes out in sort of a defatted state. So all the fats will run out first, and the solids will refine and come out. So at that point, we'll want to toss those back into the stone melangeurs so they can recombine those fats and solids, and also reshape the particles of the solids, because when they come off the mill, because they're coming through a really flat space really quickly, they come out, while those particles are really small, they come out flattened and sort of almost like splinter shaped, when what you want is like a pearl shape or something that's going to roll off your palate. So we have to toss them back in there, let them mix around. And then from there, we will want to turn that liquid chocolate into the bar form that we have in front of us now. And to do that, you have to do another process, that's called tempering. And that's a process of aligning the polymorphic crystals so that they all are, melting and hardening at the same temperature. We like to, on our tours and our classes at our factory, we like to liken it to, for people who are into Game of Thrones or Lord of the Rings, making a sword, only on a much less intense temperature range. So we'll temper that chocolate, melt all the polymorphic crystals out at around 120 degrees, take it through a temperature range down to, depending on the type of chocolate, anywhere between 82 and 85 degrees, and heat that up a little bit more so that it's easy to work with, and then pour it into chocolate bars.
Awesome. All right, so we're running out of time, but we have to get to some of the flavors.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, because you've talked to, you know, how you're
talk
not
about
roasting.
How we make it and
yeah,
not
so
roasting.
You're selecting raw beans and further developing these flavors.
Yep.
So you brought some chocolate in. We're eating the Cabernet Sauvignon. It says Peru 68% cacao. So talk a little. Let's just use this bar as an example.
So this is a really cool bean that we source from the lower Andes in Peru, about 300 miles directly east of Lima. It's a coffee growing region that about a decade ago, the farmers in their farmer meetings were noticing, wow, like, our coffee isn't growing at the same altitudes as it was before. The like climate must be changing. And so they decided that they would start planting this cacao that grew in the riverbeds and in the lowlands at some of the higher, that grew wildly in the riverbeds at some of the higher altitudes. And so what's unique to them as opposed to a lot of regions in Latin America is that the cacao production was not jump-started by USAID or a local government initiative. It was jump-started by the farmers being like, we have this cacao that grows, and we can't grow as much coffee as we used to. Let's grow what we have here. So their genetics are not pure, but purer than you find in a lot of other areas.
That's fascinating.
So that's what these beans are. And we take them and we steam them before we process them. We steam them over simmering Cabernet Sauvignon to infuse the fat of that cocoa butter with the wine flavor. And we do that with a buffet table, because that was the, when we decided we did this bar as like sort of a test bar, as part of our subscription program, and then is our seasonal product. And then we were like, okay, how are we going to do this on a large scale if we want to steam a lot of nibs and make sure that like, that the nibs, that the cocoa butter really absorbs the flavor. We don't want something that's too deep, so we just got a massive buffet table, and we pour the wine in there instead of water, and we put the nibs in perforated sheet pans, and
infuse them that way. That's pretty cool.
That way. So yeah, we really try to. These beans have sort of a wine-like characteristic to them to begin with, and that's one thing that we really try to do is instead of thinking about inclusion and infusion as flavoring the chocolate, it's more for us about pairing a flavor with a flavor that we already find in the bean. Like, so for instance, for our bourbon bar, we're using this bean right now from Tanzania that has a bright like sort of cherry note to it, and so we think about this bar as being more of like an old fashioned now and not just like chocolate aged in bourbon barrels.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about where, so you mentioned a subscription. So where can people get your chocolates?
Sure. So we're all over the city. We're in most states. We're in most Whole Foods in the country. A lot of cheese shops, wine shops, specialty grocery stores, that sort of thing. In New York, we're in Union Market. We're in Murray's. We're in Stinky. Lots of places that chocolate.
Yes.
We're good stuff sold.
And nice,
yes.
Yeah, nice products are sold. Generally in a lot of Whole Foods. If you're listening in Texas, we're available in Central Market. If you're listening in Southern California, we're available at Erewhon Market. So, yeah, generally nicer grocery stores, cheese shops, wine shops on our website, rockachocolate.com. Hmm.
I love that you have this. So I've used this, and I've never taken the wrapper off the foil before.
I mean, I have to say that it's great to hear how much you highlight the machines that are used, because everybody likes to romanticize that things are done by hand. But as people that actually make things, we know that nobody makes anything
for
by
sure.
hand.
And that's
all made by machine.
And that's something that you sort of grapple with when scaling up a business, too, of looking like, okay, in order to make this work, things need to be efficient. And what are the areas that we can remove human touch so that the humans working on this product are working specifically on flavor and can do more experiments around flavor, can do more data tracking around flavor, can do all kinds of things to improve the product and not scrape out a bucket. So we actually are getting ready to install some piping in our factory so that we can pump melted chocolate from a few machines to another machine so that we don't have to watch people scrape out buckets. So people can be working on test batches and that sort of thing, you know?
I mean, it's also people don't realize that somebody craftsmen made those machines.
Yeah, so for sure.
The machines were made by hand, and then people that make the chocolate use the machine that was made by hand.
The company that made our piping is a company that is like a family business that's based in Italy. They were originally a chocolate factory and have transitioned to making chocolate machines for small chocolate manufacturers. And since they have like generations of experience, they can do it better than like someone who's coming into it.
Imagine the piping's really cool. I bet it's heated or something to keep moving.
Water jacketed. Yeah,
that's
for sure.
Cool. Water jacketed.
And people can, when are you open? People can come by?
Yeah, we're open every day from 10 to 6. And I think on Saturdays we're open till like 8. And we have classes and tours on the weekends that are really
and
fun
your
for
website?
People. Rockachocolate.com.
And that's RAAKA. Now, I have to ask, because you brought the strawberry basil, and I know I bought one. You had a pink lemonade, right?
Raspberry lemonade.
Raspberry
lemonade.
Okay.
Raspberry lemonade.
Last summer. I just want you to talk a little bit about
it. Sure. So we do a subscription program called First Nibs that really pushes me and the rest of our staff to think exactly about that, to think about the way different flavors interact with the beans. So we make two unique bars every month. And people can sign up and sort of go on this journey with us of like starting from a single ingredient and thinking about how it's going to interact with chocolate. So this is our quarterly seasonal release that our subscribers vote on as their favorite from the previous few months. So recently we hooked up with the guys at Winsun, who are the sponsors of the show today, and we did some Taiwanese themed chocolate bar. So we did a persimmon and black sesame chocolate bar, and we did a five spice and cayenne chocolate bar. And they actually came down to the factory and we tasted a bunch of beans and thought about the ways in which the flavors of the beans would interact with the flavors we want to add to them. So that was really fun. And they ended up putting it on their menu as an addition to their ice cream sandwich. You could choose which bar you want to add to the ice cream sandwich, which was really fun. And then this month, we're doing rosemary and dulse, which is a red sea lettuce, and cedar leaf and lemon verbena.
And can people that aren't... These are like a... I picked up the raspberry lemonade.
We release these quarterly, which are like the favorites. And then after the first of the month, we sell our leftovers at our factory to whoever comes on by. So there, if you come down to the factory, you'll get some you'll get introduced to some fun limited flavors that aren't available in stores.
Awesome. Right. I haven't done it. Yeah. Red Hook Walkabout. Now that it's spring, yeah, I can resume my walkabout.
For sure.
Awesome. Well, I think we're going to have you back to talk, because I want to talk more in depth about, I'm obsessed with tasting things and smelling things. So
for sure.
We didn't get too in depth about tasting chocolate.
Definitely.
And about more kind of what goes through your head when you're, you know, evaluating. So I definitely, we will be revisiting with you at some point.
Excellent.
Not too far in the future. But thank you so much for being on.
Yeah,
I personally
you.
Learned a ton. Thanks to Dave for hanging out and contributing. Thanks to all of you for listening. Again, our 200th episode. So next week will be our last show of the season. We'll have a couple weeks off, and then we're going to come back for an absolutely amazing spring season. So cheers. Foment about it.
Foment about it.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.